course, have to marry. It was nothing more than she knew, but there was something awful in the way he said it. Maybe it was the lack of emotion in his voice, as if she were a problem he had to solve. Or maybe it was the way he said it so matter-of-factly, as if she had no choice, which in truth she did not, but she didn't care to be reminded of that. Whatever it was, it made her feel strange and itchy, as if she needed to jump out of her skin. She had spent her adult life making her own choices, had considered herself the luckiest of females because her family had allowed her to do so. Maybe that was why it now felt so unbearable to be forced onto a path before she was ready. Or maybe it was unbearable because she was the one who had set this entire farce into motion. She was furious with herself, and it was making her snippy with everyone.
"I'll do my best to make you happy," he said gruffly. "And the children need a mother."
She smiled weakly. She'd wanted her marriage to be about more than just children.
"I'm sure you'll be a great help," he said.
"A great help," she echoed, hating the way it sounded.
"Wouldn't you agree?"
She nodded, mostly because she was afraid that if she opened her mouth she might scream.
"Good," he said. "Then it's all settled."
It's all settled. For the rest of her life, that would be her grand proposal of marriage. It's all settled. And the worst part of it was, she had no right to complain. She was the one who'd run off without giving Philip enough time to arrange for a chaperone. She was the one who'd been so eager to make her own destiny. She was the one who'd acted without thinking. And now all she had to show for it was, "It's all settled." She swallowed.
"Wonderful."
He looked at her, blinking in confusion.
"Aren't you happy?"
"Of course,"
she said hollowly.
"You don't sound happy."
"I'm happy,"
she snapped. Philip muttered something under his breath.
"What did you say?"
she asked.
"Nothing."
"You said something."
He gave her an impatient look.
"If I'd meant for you to hear it, I would have said it out loud."
She sucked in her breath.
"Then you shouldn't have said it at all."
"Some things," Philip muttered, "are impossible to keep inside."
"What did you say?"
she demanded. Philip raked his hand through his hair.
"Heloise."
"Did you insult me?"
"Do you really want to know?"
"Since it appears we are to be wed,"
she bit off.
"Yes."
"I don't recall my exact words," Philip shot back, "but I believe I may have uttered the words women and lack of sense in the same breath."
He shouldn't have said it. He knew he shouldn't have said it. It would have been rude under any circumstances, and it was especially wrong right now. But she had pushed and pushed and pushed and wouldn't back down. It was like she'd sliced a needle under his skin and then decided to jab just for the fun of it. And besides, why was she in such a terrible mood anyway? All he'd done was state the facts. They would have to marry. And frankly, she should have been glad that if she'd been compromised, at least it had been with a man who was willing to do the right thing and wed her. He didn't expect gratitude. Hell, this was as much his fault as it was hers. He was the one who'd issued the initial invitation, after all. But was it too much to expect a smile and a pleasant mood?
"I'm glad we had this conversation," Eloise said quite suddenly. "This has been good."
He looked up, instantly suspicious.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Very beneficial," she said. "One should always understand one's spouse before one marries, and..."
He groaned. This was not going to end well.
"And,"
she added sharply, glaring at his groan,
"it is certainly provident that I now know how you feel about my gender."
He was the sort who usually walked away from conflict. But really, this was too much.
"If I recall correctly," he shot back, "I never did tell you exactly what I thought of women."
"I inferred it," she retorted. "The phrase, lack of sense, pointed me in the correct direction."
"Did it?" he drawled. "Well, I'm thinking differently now."
Her eyes narrowed.
"What do you mean?"
I mean that I've changed my mind. I've decided I don't have difficulties with women in general, after all. It's you I find insufferable." She drew back, clearly affronted. "Has no one called you insufferable before?" He found that difficult to believe.
"No one who wasn't related to me," she grumbled.
"You must live in a very polite society." He squirmed in his seat again. "Really, did no one make chairs for large men any more?" "Either that," he muttered, "or you've simply terrified everyone into bending to your every whim." She flushed, and he couldn't tell if it was because she was embarrassed by his spot-on assessment of her personality, or just because she was angry beyond words. Probably both.
"I'm sorry," she muttered.
He turned to her in surprise. "I beg your pardon." He couldn't have heard correctly.
"I said, I'm sorry," she repeated,
making it clear that she was not going to say the words a third time, so he'd better be listening well. "Oh," he said, too stunned to say much of anything else. "Thank you."
"You're welcome."
Her tone was less than gracious, but she seemed to be trying hard nonetheless. For a moment he said nothing. Then he had to ask, "What for?" She looked up, obviously irritated that that hadn't been the end of it.
"Did you have to ask?" she grumbled.
"Well, yes."
"I am sorry," she ground out, "because I am in a horrid mood and have been behaving badly. And if you ask how I have been behaving badly, I swear I will get up and walk away and you will never see me again. Because I assure you, this apology is difficult enough without my having to explain it further."
Philip decided he couldn't possibly hope for more. "Thank you," he said softly. He held his tongue for a minute, quite possibly the longest minute of his life. Then he decided he might as well just go ahead and say it. "If it makes you feel any better," he told her, "I had decided we would suit before your brothers arrived. I was already planning to ask you to be my wife, properly, with a ring and whatever else it is I'm supposed to do. I don't know, it's been a long while since I've proposed marriage to anyone, and last time wasn't under normal circumstances in any case." She looked up at him, surprise in her eyes, and perhaps a little bit of gratitude as well. "I'm sorry that your brothers came along and made it all happen faster than you were ready for," he added. "But I'm not sorry that it's happening."
"You're not?" she whispered. "Really?"
"I'll give you as long as you need," he said. "Within reason, of course. But I cannot..." He glanced up the hill. Anthony and Colin were ambling down toward them, followed by a footman carrying a tray of food. "I cannot speak for your brothers. I dare say they won't care to wait as long as you might prefer. And quite frankly, if you were my sister, I'd have marched you to a church last night." She looked up the hill at her brothers. They were still at least a half a minute away. She opened her mouth, then closed it in obvious thought. Finally, after several seconds, during which he could practically see the wheels of her mind churning and turning, she blurted out,
"Why did you decide we would suit?"
"I beg your pardon." It was a stalling tactic, of course. He hadn't expected such a direct question. Although heaven knew why not. This was Eloise, after all.
"Why did you decide we would suit?" she repeated,
her voice pointed and undeniable. But of course that would be how she would ask it. There was nothing subtle or deniable about Eloise Bridgerton. She would never skirt around an issue when she could just walk right in and stick her nose directly into the heart of the matter. "I..." He coughed, cleared his throat.
"You don't know,"
she stated, sounding disappointed. "Of course I know," he protested. No man liked to be told he didn't know his own mind.
"No, you don't. If you did, you wouldn't be sitting there choking on air."
"Good God, woman, do you have a charitable bone in your body? A man needs time to formulate an answer." "Ah," came Colin Bridgerton's ever-genial voice. "Here's the happy couple." Philip had never been so glad to see another human being in all his life. "Good morning," he said to the two Bridgerton men, inordinately pleased to have escaped Eloise's interrogation. "Hungry?" Colin inquired, as he sat in the chair next to Philip. "I took the liberty of having the kitchen prepare breakfast al fresco." Philip looked over at the footman and wondered if he ought to offer to help. The poor man looked nearly ready to collapse under the weight of the food.
"How are you this morning?"
Anthony asked, as he sat down on the cushioned bench next to Eloise.
"Fine," she replied.
"Hungry?"
"No." "Cheerful?"
"Not for you."
Anthony turned to Philip.
"She's usually more conversational."
Philip wondered if Eloise would hit him. It wouldn't be more than he deserved. The tray of food came down on the table with a loud clatter, followed by the footman's abject apology for being so clumsy, followed by Antony's assurance that it was no trouble at all, that Hercules himself could not carry enough food to suit Colin. The two Bridgerton brothers served themselves. Then Antony turned to Eloise and Philip and said,
"The two of you certainly seem well suited this morning."
Eloise looked at him with open hostility.
"When did you reach that conclusion?"
"It only took a moment," he said with a shrug.
He looked at Philip.
"It was the bickering, actually. All the best couples do it."
"I'm glad to hear it," Philip murmured.
"My wife and I often have similar conversations, before she comes around to my way of thinking,"
Antony said affably. Eloise shot him a peevish expression.
"Of course, my wife might offer a different interpretation," he added with a shrug. "I allow her to think that I'm coming round to her way of thinking."
He turned back to Philip and smiled.
"It's easier that way."
Philip stole a glance at Eloise. She appeared to be working very hard to hold her tongue.
"When did you arrive?" Anthony asked him. "Just a few minutes ago," he replied.
"Yes," Eloise said. "He proposed marriage. I'm sure you'll be happy to hear."
Philip coughed with surprise at her sudden announcement.
"I beg your pardon."
Eloise turned to Anthony.
"He said, we'll have to marry."
"Well, he's right,"
Anthony replied, settling a level stare directly on her face.
"You do have to marry. And my compliments to him for not beating around the bush about it. I think you, of all people, would appreciate direct conversation."
"Scone, anyone?"
Colin asked.
"No? More for me, then."
Anthony turned to Philip and said, "She's just a bit irritated because she hates being ordered about. She'll be fine in a few days."
"I'm fine right now," Eloise ground out.
"Yes," Anthony murmured. "You look fine."
"Don't you have somewhere to be?"
Eloise asked, through her teeth.
"An interesting question," her brother replied. "One might say that I ought to be in London, with my wife and children. In fact, if I did have somewhere else to be, I imagine that would be it. But strangely enough, I seem to be here, in Wiltshire, where, when I woke in my comfortable bed in London 3 days ago, I would never have guessed I would be."
He smiled blandly.
"Any other questions?"
She was quiet at that. Anthony handed an envelope to Eloise.
"This arrived for you."
She looked down, and Philip could see that she instantly recognized the handwriting.
"It's from Mother," Anthony said, even though it was clear she already knew that. "Do you want to read it?"
Philip asked. She shook her head.
"Not now,"
which meant, he realized, not in front of her brothers. And then, suddenly, he knew what he had to do.
"Lord Bridgerton,"
he said to Anthony, standing up,
"might I request a moment alone with your sister?"
"You just had a moment alone with her,"
Colin said between bites of bacon. Philip ignored him.
"My lord."
"Of course,"
Anthony said, "if she's agreeable."
Philip grabbed Eloise's hand and yanked her to her feet.
"She's agreeable," he said.
Colin
remarked. "She looks very agreeable."
Philip decided then and there that all the Bridgertons ought to be fitted with muzzles.
"Come with me,"
he said to Eloise, before she had a chance to argue, which of course she would, since she was Eloise, and she would never smile politely and follow when an argument was a possibility.
"Where are we going?"
she gasped, once he had pulled her away from her family and was striding across the lawn, unmindful of how she had to run to keep up. "I don't know."
"You don't know?"
He stopped so quickly that she crashed into him. It was rather nice, actually. He could feel every last bit of her, from her breasts to her thighs, although she recovered all too quickly and stepped away before he could savour the moment. "I've never been here before," he said, explaining it to her as if she were a small child. "I'd have to be a bloody clairvoyant to know where I'm going."
"Oh," she said. "Well, then, lead the way."
He pulled her back to the house, making his way to a side door.
"Where does this go?" he asked.
"Inside," she replied.
He gave her a sarcastic look.
"Through Sophie's writing room to the hall," Eloise expanded.
"Is Sophie in her writing room?"
"I doubt it. Didn't she go to fetch you lemonade?"
"Good."
He pulled the door open, muttering a quick thanks that it was unlocked, and poked his head inside. The room was empty, but the door to the hall was open, so he strode across and pulled it shut. When he turned back around, Eloise was still standing in the open doorway to the outside, watching him with a blend of curiosity and amusement.
"Shut the door,"
he ordered. Her brows rose.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Shut it."
It wasn't a tone of voice he used often, but after a year of floating along, of feeling lost amid the currents of his life, he was finally taking control. And he knew exactly what he wanted.
"Shut the door, Eloise,"
he said in a low voice, moving slowly across the room toward her. Her eyes widened.
"Philip,"
she whispered.
"I
don't talk," he said. "Just shut the door."
But she was frozen in place, staring at him as if she didn't know him, which, in truth, she didn't. Hell, he wasn't so sure he knew himself any longer.
"Philip, you..."
He reached behind her and shut the door for her, turning the lock with a loud and ominous click.
"What are you doing?"
she asked.
"You were worried," he said, "that we might not suit."
Her lips parted. He stepped forward.
"I think it's time I showed you that we do."
Chapter 12.
"And how did you know that you and Simon were well suited for marriage? For I vow, I have not met a man about which I might say the same, and this after 3 long seasons on the marriage mart."
From Eloise Bridgerton to her sister, the Duchess of Hastings, upon refusing her 3rd proposal of marriage. Eloise had time to breathe, barely, before his mouth came down on hers, and it was a good thing she did, because it didn't feel as if he had any plans to release her until, oh, the next millennium. But then, abruptly, he drew back, his large hands cradling her face, and he looked at her. Just looked at her.
"What?"
she asked, uncomfortable with his scrutiny. She knew she was considered to be attractive, but she was no legendary beauty, and he was examining her as if he wanted to catalogue her every feature.
"I wanted to see you,"
he whispered. He touched her cheek, then smoothed his thumb down the line of her jaw.
"You're always in motion. I don't get to just see you."
Her legs turned wobbly, and her lips parted. But she couldn't seem to make them work, couldn't seem to do anything other than stare up into his dark eyes.
"You're so beautiful," he murmured. "Do you know what I thought when I saw you the first time?"
She shook her head, desperate for his words.
"I thought I could drown in your eyes. I thought..."
He moved in closer, his words now as much breath as sound.
"I could drown in you."
She felt herself swaying toward him. He touched her lips, tickling the tender skin with his forefinger. The motion sent ripples of pleasure throughout her, right down to the centre of her being, to places forbidden even to her. And she realized that she had never really understood the power of desire until that very moment, never really understood what it was at all.
"Kiss me," she whispered.
He smiled.
"You always order me about.
Kiss me."
"Are you sure?"
he murmured, his mouth curved into a teasing smile.
"Because once I do, I might not be able to..."
She grabbed the back of his head and yanked him down. He chuckled against her lips, his arms tightening around her with uncompromising strength. She opened her mouth, welcoming his invasion, moaning with pleasure as his tongue swept in, exploring her warmth. He nibbled and licked, slowly stirring a fire within her, all the while pressing her closer and closer against him until his heat poured through her clothing, wrapping her in a haze of desire. His hand stole around her back, then down to her derriere, squeezing and kneading, then tilting her up until she gasped. She was 28 years old, old enough to have heard indiscreet whispers. She knew what his hardness meant. She'd just never expected it to feel quite so hot, so insistent. She jerked back, the motion more instinct than anything else. But he wouldn't let her go, pulled her closer and groaned, rubbing her against him.
"I want to be inside you,"
he groaned in her ear. Her legs completely gave out. It didn't matter, of course. He just held her even tighter, then sank her onto the sofa, coming down atop her until the full length of him pressed her into the soft, cream-coloured cushions. He was heavy, but his weight was thrilling, and she could do nothing but loll her head back as his lips left hers to travel down the column of her throat.
"Philip,"
she moaned, and then again, as if his name were the only word left to her.
"Yes," he grunted. "Yes."
His words seemed torn from his throat, and she had no idea what he was talking about, only that whatever he was saying yes to, she wanted it too. She wanted everything. Anything he wanted, anything possible. She wanted everything that was possible, and everything impossible too. There was no more reason, only sensation, only need and desire, and this overwhelming sense of now. This wasn't about yesterday, and it wasn't about tomorrow. This was now, and she wanted it all. She felt his hand on her ankle, rough and calloused, as it moved up her leg until it reached the edge of her stocking. He didn't pause, did nothing to implicitly ask her permission, but she gave it anyway, urging her legs apart until he settled more firmly between them, giving him more room to caress, more space to tickle her skin. He moved up and up and up, pausing every now and then to squeeze, and she thought she might die from the waiting. She was on fire, burning for him, feeling strange and wet, and so completely unlike herself, she thought she might dissolve into a pool of nothingness, or evaporate completely, or maybe even explode. And then, just when she was quite convinced that nothing could be stranger, nothing could wind her even tighter than she was, he touched her. Touched her. Touched her where no one had ever touched her, where she didn't dare touch herself. Touched her so intimately, so tenderly, that she had to bite her lip to keep from screaming his name. And as his finger slid inside, she knew that in that moment she no longer belonged to herself. She was his. Sometime later, much later, she'd be herself again, back in control, with all her powers and faculties. But for now, she was his. In this moment, for this second, she lived for him, for all he could make her feel, for every last whisper of pleasure, each moan of desire.
"Philip,"
she gasped, his name a plea, a promise, a question. It was whatever she needed to say to make sure he didn't stop. She had no idea where this was all heading, whether she'd even be the same person when it was done. But it had to go somewhere. She couldn't possibly continue in this state forever. She was wound so tight, so tense that she'd surely shatter. She was near the end. She had to be. She needed something. She needed release, and she knew that only he could give it to her. She arched to him, pressed up with a power she would never have imagined she possessed, actually lifting them both off the sofa with her need. Her hands found his shoulders, biting into his muscles, then moved down to the small of his back in an effort to pull him even closer against her.
"Eloise,"
he groaned, sliding his other hand up her skirt until it found her backside.
"Do you have any idea?"
And then she had no idea what he did. He probably didn't know either, but her entire body went impossibly tense. She couldn't speak, couldn't even breathe, as her mouth opened into a silent scream of surprise and delight, and 100 other things all rolled into one. And then, just when she thought she couldn't possibly survive even a second longer, she shuddered and collapsed beneath him, panting with exhaustion, so limp and spent she couldn't have moved even her littlest finger.
"Oh, my God,"
she finally said, the blasphemy the only words coursing through her mind.
"Oh, my God."
His hands tightened on her backside.
"Oh, my God."
His hand moved, came up to stroke her hair. He was gentle, achingly gentle, even though his body was rigid and tense. Eloise just lay there, wondering if she'd ever be able to move again, breathing against him as she felt his breath on her temple. Eventually, he shifted and moved, mumbling something about being too heavy for her, and then there was nothing but air, and when she looked to the side, he was kneeling next to the sofa, smoothing her skirts back down. It seemed a rather tender and gentlemanly gesture, given her recent wantonness. She looked into his face, knowing she must have the silliest smile on hers.
"Oh, Philip,"
she sighed.
"Is there a washroom?"
he asked hoarsely. She blinked, noticing for the first time that he looked rather strained.
"A washroom?" she echoed.
He nodded stiffly. She pointed to the door leading to the hall.
"Out and to the right," she said.
It was hard to believe he needed to relieve himself right after such a thrilling encounter. But who was she to attempt to understand the workings of the male body? He walked to the door, put his hand on the knob, then turned around.
"Do you believe me now?"
he asked, one of his brows rising into an impossibly arrogant arch. Her lips parted in confusion.
"About what?"
He smiled, slowly, and all he said was,
"We'll suit."
Philip had no idea how long it would take Eloise to regain her composure and restore her appearance. She'd looked quite delectably dishevelled when he'd left her on the sofa in Sophie Bridgerton's little office. He never could understand the intricacies of a woman's toilette, and was quite certain he never would, but he was fairly sure she was going to need to redress her hair at the very least. As for him, he required less than a minute in the washroom to find his release. He was wound that tight from his encounter with Eloise. Dear God, she was magnificent. It had been so long since he'd been with a woman. He'd known that when he finally found one he wanted to bed, that his body would react strongly. He'd had more years than he'd cared to count, with only his hand to satisfy his needs. A female body seemed like pure bliss, and heaven knew he had imagined one often enough. But this had been different, not at all what he'd pictured in his mind. He'd been mad for her, for her, for the sounds that escaped her throat, for the scent of her skin, for the way his body seemed to fit perfectly in the crook of hers. Even though he'd had to finish off himself, he'd still felt more and more intensely than he'd ever thought possible. He'd thought almost any female body would do, but it was now quite clear to him that there was a reason he'd never availed himself of the services of the whores and barmaids who'd expressed their willingness. There was a reason he'd never found himself a discreet widow. He'd needed more. He'd needed Eloise. He wanted to sink himself into her and never come out. He wanted to own her, to possess her, and then to lay back and let her torture him until he screamed. He'd had fantasies before. Hell, every man did. But now his fantasy had a face, and he feared he was going to find himself walking around with a constant erection if he didn't learn how to control his thoughts. He needed a wedding. Fast. He groaned, giving his hands a quick wash in the basin. She didn't know she'd left him in such a state. She didn't even realize. She'd just looked at him with that blissful smile, too caught in her own passion to notice that he was ready to explode. He pushed open the door, his feet moving quickly along the marble floor as he made his way back to the lawn. He'd have plenty of time to explode soon enough. And when he did, she'd be right there along with him. The thought brought a smile to his lips and very nearly sent him back into the washroom.
"Ah, there he is," Benedict Bridgerton said,
as Philip walked toward him across the lawn. Philip saw the gun in his hand and stopped in his tracks, wondering if he ought to be worried. Benedict couldn't possibly know what had just happened in his wife's office, could he? Philip swallowed, thinking hard. No, there was no way. And besides, Benedict was smiling. Of course, he could be the sort who would enjoy picking off the spoiler of his sister's innocence.
Good morning, Philip said,
glancing at everyone else in an attempt to gauge the situation. Benedict nodded his greeting, then said,
Do you shoot?
Of course, Philip replied.
Good.
He jerked his head toward a target.
Join us.
Philip noted with relief that the target seemed to be firmly in place, indicating that he would not have to play that role.
I didn't bring a pistol, he said.
Of course not, Benedict replied.
Why would you? We're all friends here.
His brows rose.
Aren't we?
One would hope. Benedict's lips curved, but it wasn't the sort of smile that inspired confidence in one's well-being.
Don't worry about the pistol, he said. We'll provide one.
Philip nodded. If this was to be how he was to prove his manhood to Eloise's brothers, so be it. He could shoot as well as the best of them. It had been one of those manly pursuits his father had been so insistent he learn. He'd spent countless hours outside Romney Hall, his arm outstretched until his muscles burned, holding his breath as he aimed for whatever it was his father was out to destroy. Every shot was accompanied by a fervent prayer that his aim would be true. If he hit the target, his father wouldn't hit him. It was as simple and desperate as that. He walked over to a table with several pistols on it, murmuring his hellos to Anthony, Colin, and Gregory. Sophie was sitting about 10 or so yards away, her nose in a book.
"Let's get on with this," Anthony said, "before Eloise returns."
He looked over at Philip.
"Where is Eloise?"
"She went off to read the letter from your mother," Philip lied.
"I see. Well, that won't take long,"
Anthony said with a frown.
"We'd better hurry, then."
"Maybe she'll want to reply,"
Colin said, picking up a gun and examining it.
"That'll buy us a few extra minutes. You know Eloise. She's always writing someone a letter."
"Indeed," Anthony replied. "Got us into this mess, didn't it?"
Philip just looked at him with an inscrutable smile. He was far too pleased with himself this morning to rise to any bait Anthony Bridgerton cared to offer. Gregory chose a gun.
"Even if she replies, she'll be back soon. She's fiendishly fast."
"At writing?" Philip queried.
"At everything," Gregory said grimly. "Let's shoot."
"Why are you all so eager to get started without Eloise?" Philip asked.
No reason," Benedict said.
At precisely the same moment Anthony mumbled,
"Who said anything about that?"
They all had, of course, but Philip didn't remind them of it.
"Age before beauty, old chap,"
Colin said, slapping Anthony on the back.
"You're too kind,"
Anthony murmured, stepping up to a chalk line someone had drawn in the grass. He lifted his arm, took aim, and fired.
"Well done,"
Philip said, once the footman had brought forth the bullseye. Anthony had not hit dead centre, but he was only an inch off.
"Thank you."
He set his pistol down.
"How old are you?"
Philip blinked at the unexpected question, then replied,
30.
Anthony jerked his head toward Colin.
"You're after Colin, then. We always do these things by age. It's the only way to keep track."
"By all means," Philip said, watching as Benedict and Colin took their turns. They were both good shots, neither dead centre, but certainly close enough to kill a man, had that been their goal. Which, thankfully, it didn't seem to be, at least not that morning. Philip selected a pistol, tested its weight in his hand, then stepped up to the chalk line. It had only been recently that he'd stopped thinking of his father every time he took aim at a target. It had taken years, but he'd finally allowed himself to realise that he actually liked shooting, that it didn't have to be a chore. And then suddenly his father's voice, so often at the back of his mind, always yelling, always criticising, was gone. He lifted his arm, his muscles rock steady, and fired. He squinted toward the target. It looked good. The footman brought it forward. 1/2 inch, at most, off the centre. Closer than anyone else thus far. The target went back, and Gregory took his turn, proving himself to be Philip's equal.
"We do 5 rounds, Anthony told Philip. "Best out, and if there's a tie, the leaders face off."
"I see," Philip said.
"Any particular reason?"
"No," Anthony said, picking up his gun.
"Just that we've always done it this way."
Colin looked at Philip with deadly, serious eyes.
"We take our games seriously."
"I'm gathering."
"Do you fence?"
"Not well," Philip said. One corner of Colin's mouth turned up.
"Excellent." "Be quiet,"
Anthony barked, looking testily over at them.
"I'm trying to aim." "Such need for silence will not serve you well at a time of crisis,"
Colin remarked.
"Shut up," Anthony bit off.
"If we were attacked," Colin continued, one of his hands moving expressively as he wove his tail,
"it would be quite noisy. And frankly, I find it disturbing to think..." "Colin!"
Anthony bellowed.
"Don't mind me," Colin said. "I'm going to kill him," Anthony announced. "Does anyone mind if I kill him?"
No one did, although Sophie did look up and mentioned something about blood and messes and not wanting to have to clean up.
"It's an excellent fertilizer,"
Philip said helpfully, since, after all, that was his area of expertise. "Ah," Sophie nodded and turned back to her book. "Kill him, then."
"How's that book, darling?" Benedict called out to her.
"It's quite good, actually."
"Will you all shut up?"
Anthony ground out. Then, his cheeks colouring slightly, he turned to his sister-in-law and mumbled,
"Not you, of course, Sophie."
"Glad to be exempted," she said cheerfully.
"Do try not to threaten my wife,"
Benedict said mildly. Anthony turned to his brother and skewered him with a glare.
"The lot of you should be drawn and quartered," he grunted. "Except for Sophie,"
Colin reminded him. Anthony turned to him with a deadly expression.
"You do realise this gun is loaded, don't you?"
"Lucky for me, fratricide is considered quite beyond the pale." Anthony clamped his mouth shut and turned back toward the target.
"Round 2,
he called out, taking aim.
"Wait!"
All 4 Bridgerton men sagged and turned around, groaning as they saw Eloise careening down the hill.
"Are you shooting?"
she demanded, stumbling to a halt. No one answered. No one really needed to. It was quite obvious.
"Without me?"
"We're not shooting," Gregory said. just standing about with guns. Near a target, Colin added helpfully.
You're shooting.
Of course we're shooting, Anthony snapped.
He flicked his head off to the right.
Sophie is by herself. You should keep her company.
Eloise planted her hands on her hips.
Sophie is reading a book. A good one, too,
Sophie put in, returning her attention to the pages.
You should read a book, too, Eloise, Benedict suggested. They're very improving.
I don't need any improving, she shot back. Give me a gun.
I'm not giving you a gun, Benedict retorted. We don't have enough to go around.
We can share, Eloise ground out. Have you ever tried sharing? It's very improving.
Benedict scowled at her in a manner that wasn't particularly fitting for a man of his years.
I think, Colin said, that what Benedict was trying to say is that he's as improved as he's ever going to be.
For certain,
Sophie said, not even raising her eyes from her book.
Here, Philip said magnanimously, handing his gun to Eloise. Have mine.
The four Bridgerton men groaned, but he decided he rather enjoyed annoying them.
Thank you,
Eloise said graciously.
From Antony's bark of round two, I deduce that you've each taken one shot.
Indeed, Philip replied. He looked over at her brothers, all of whom wore dejected expressions. What's wrong? Antony just shook his head. Philip looked to Benedict.
She's a freak of nature,
Benedict muttered. Philip looked back at Eloise with renewed interest. She didn't look particularly freakish to him.
I'm dropping out, Gregory muttered. I haven't eaten breakfast yet. You'll have to ring for more, Colin told him. I already finished it all.
Gregory let out an annoyed sigh.
It's a wonder I haven't starved, he grumbled. Younger brother that I am.
Colin shrugged.
You've got to be quick if you want to eat.
Anthony looked at the two of them with disgust.
Did the two of you grow up in an orphanage?
He asked. Philip bit his lip to contain his smile.
Are we going to shoot?
Eloise demanded.
You certainly are,
Gregory said, slumping against a tree.
I'm leaving to eat.
He stayed, though, watching his sister with a bored expression as she lifted her arm and, without even appearing to aim, fired. Philip blinked in surprise as the footman brought forth the target. Dead centre.
Where did you learn to do that?
He asked, trying not to gape. She shrugged.
I couldn't tell you. I've always been able to do it.
Freak of nature, Colin muttered, clearly. I think it's splendid, Philip said.
Eloise looked at him with glowing eyes.
Do you really?
Of course. Should I ever need to defend my home, I shall know who to send out to the front line.
She beamed.
Where's the next target?
Gregory threw his arms up in disgust.
I forfeit. I'm getting something to eat. Get something for me, too,
Colin called out.
Of course,
Gregory muttered. Eloise turned to Anthony.
Is it your turn now?
He took the gun from her hands and set it on the table to be reloaded.
As if it matters.
We have to do all five rounds, she said officiously. You were the one who made the rules.
I know,
he said glumly. He lifted his arm and fired off a shot, but his heart clearly was not into it, and he was off by 5 inches.
You're not even trying,
Eloise accused. Anthony just turned to Benedict and said,
I hate shooting with her.
Your turn,
Eloise said to Benedict. He took his turn, as did Colin, both men putting in a bit more effort than Anthony had, but still coming up off the mark. Philip stepped up to the chalk line, pausing only to listen, as Eloise said,
Don't you decide to give up?
I wouldn't dream of it, he murmured.
Good. It's no fun to play with bad sports.
She directed the last two words quite vehemently toward her brothers.
That's the point, Benedict said.
They do this every time,
Eloise said to Philip.
They shoot badly until I decide the match isn't worth it, and then they all have fun.
Be quiet,
Philip told her, lips twitching.
I'm aiming.
Oh. She shut her mouth with alacrity, watching with interest as he focused on the target. Philip took his shot, allowing himself a slow, satisfied smile as the target was brought forward.
Perfect! Eloise exclaimed, clapping her hands together. Oh, Philip, that was wonderful!
Anthony muttered something under his breath that he probably ought not to have said in his sister's presence, then added, directing his words to Philip,
You are going to marry her, aren't you? Because, frankly, if you get her off of our hands and allow her to shoot with you so that she doesn't pester us, I'll gladly double her dowry.
Philip was quite certain at that point that he'd wed her for nothing, but he just grinned and said,
It's a deal.
Chapter 13.
And as I'm sure you can imagine, they were all possessed of a most foul temper. Is it my fault I am so superior? I think not. No more, I suppose, than it is their fault they were born men, and thus without the barest hint of common sense or innate good manners.
From Eloise Bridgerton to Penelope Featherington, after trouncing six men, three not related to her, in a shooting match. The following day, Eloise travelled to Romney Hall for lunch, along with Anthony, Benedict and Sophie. Colin and Gregory had declared that the rest of the family had the situation well enough in hand and decided to return to London. Colin back to his new wife, and Gregory back to whatever it was the young unmarried men of the ton did to fill their daily lives. Eloise was happy to see them go. She loved her brothers. But truly, the four of them at once was more than any woman ought to be expected to bear. She was feeling optimistic as she stepped down from the carriage. The previous day had gone far better than she could ever have hoped. Even if Philip hadn't taken her into Sophie's office to prove to her that they would suit, Eloise could now think of those words only as if they were in quotations. The day would have been a success. Philip had more than held his own against the collective force of the Bridgerton brothers, which had left her feeling quite pleased and more than a little proud. Funny how it hadn't occurred to her until then that she could never marry a man who couldn't square off with each and any of her brothers and emerge unscathed. And in Philip's case, he'd taken on all four at once. Most impressive. Eloise still had reservations about the marriage, of course. How could she not? She and Philip had developed a sense of mutual respect, and, hopefully, even affection. But they were not in love, and Eloise had no way of knowing if they ever would be. Still, she was convinced that she was doing the right thing by marrying him. She had little choice in the matter, of course. It was either marry Philip or face complete ruin and a life alone. But even so, she thought he would make a fine husband. He was honest and honourable. And if he was at times too quiet, at least he seemed to have a sense of humour, which Eloise felt was essential for any prospective spouse. And when he kissed her, well, it was quite obvious that he knew exactly how to turn her knees to butter, and the rest of her as well. Eloise was, of course, a pragmatic. She always had been, and she knew that passion was not enough to sustain a marriage. But, she thought with a wicked smile, surely it couldn't hurt. Philip checked the clock on the mantel for about the 15th time in as many minutes. The Bridgertons were due to arrive at 12:30, and it was already 35 past the hour. Not that 5 minutes was anything to worry about when one had to travel over country roads, but still, it was deuced hard to keep Oliver and Amanda neat and tidy, and above all, well-behaved, as they waited with him in the drawing-room.
"I hate this jacket," Oliver said, tugging on his little coat. "It's too small," Amanda told him. "I know," he replied, with clear disdain. "If it weren't too small, I wouldn't have complained."
Philip rather thought he'd have found something else to complain about, but there seemed little reason to express this opinion.
"And anyway," Oliver continued, "your dress is too small, too. I can see your ankles. You're supposed to be able to see my ankles, Amanda said, frowning down at her lower legs. Not so much of them.
She looked down again, this time with an expression of alarm.
You're only 8 years old, Philip said in a weary voice. The dress is perfectly suitable.
Or at least he hoped it was, little that he knew of such things. Eloise, he thought, her name echoing through his head like the answer to his prayers. Eloise would know these things. She would know if a child's dress was too short, and when a girl should start wearing her hair up, and even whether a boy should attend Eton or Harrow. Eloise would know all these things. Thank God.
I think they're late, Oliver announced.
They're not late, Philip said automatically.
I think they are late, Oliver said. I can read the clock now, you know.
Philip didn't know, which depressed him. It was rather like the swimming thing. Too much like it, really. Eloise, he reminded himself. Whatever his failings as a father, he was making up for all of that by marrying the perfect mother for them. He was, for the first time since their birth, doing the exact right thing for his children, and the sense of relief was almost overwhelming. Eloise. She couldn't get here soon enough. Hell, he couldn't marry her soon enough. How did one procure a special license anyway? It hadn't been the sort of thing he'd ever thought he'd need to know. But the last thing he wanted to do was wait several weeks to have banns read. Weren't weddings meant to be held on Saturday mornings? Could they manage it by this Saturday? It was only 2 days away, but if they could get that special license... Philip caught Oliver by the collar as he tried to race out the door.
No, he said firmly. You will wait here for Miss Bridgerton, and you will do so quietly, without incident, and with a smile on your face.
Oliver made at least some attempt to settle down at the mention of Eloise's name, but his smile, performed obediently at his father's order, was a ghastly stretch of the lips that left Philip feeling like he'd just had an audience with an anemic gorgon.
That wasn't a smile, Amanda immediately said. It was too. No, your lips didn't even curve up.
Philip sighed as he attempted to block his ears from the inside out. He'd talked to Anthony Bridgerton about the special license this afternoon. It seemed like the sort of thing the Viscount would know about. Saturday couldn't come soon enough. He could turn the twins over to Eloise during the day and... He smiled to himself. She could turn herself over to him at night.
Why are you smiling? Amanda demanded.
I'm not smiling, Philip said, feeling himself begin to, dear God, blush.
You are smiling, she accused. And now your cheeks are turning pink.
Don't be silly, he muttered.
I'm not silly,
she insisted.
Oliver, look at Father. Don't his cheeks look pink?
One more word about my cheeks, Philip threatened, and I'm going to...
Hell, he'd been about to say horsewhip, but they all knew he would never do that.
Do something, he finished, in a lame attempt at a threat.
Amazingly, it worked, and they held still and silent for a moment. Then Amanda swung her legs from her perch on the sofa and knocked over a footstool. Philip looked at the clock.
Oops, she said, jumping down and then bending over to write it. Oliver!
She howled. Philip tore his eyes away from the minute hand, which was, inexplicably, not even to the 8. Amanda was sprawled on the floor, glaring at her brother.
He pushed me, Amanda said. Did not. Did too.
Did, Oliver,
Philip cut in.
Someone pushed her, and I'm fairly certain it was not I.
Oliver chewed on his lower lip, having forgotten to consider the fact that his culpability would be quite obvious.
Maybe she fell over on her own, he suggested.
Philip just stared at him, hoping that the ferocious expression would be enough to nip that idea in the bud.
Very well, Oliver admitted. I pushed her. I'm sorry.
Philip blinked with surprise. Maybe he was getting better at fatherhood. He couldn't recall the last time he'd heard an unsolicited apology.
"You can push me back,"
Oliver said to Amanda.
"Oh, no,"
Philip said quickly. "Bad idea. Very, very bad idea."
"All right,"
Amanda said brightly.
"No, Amanda," Philip said, jumping to his feet. "Do not."
But she'd already pressed both of her little hands to her brother's chest and heaved. Oliver went tumbling back with a loud burst of laughter.
"Now I get to push you,"
he yelled with glee.
"You will not push your sister,"
Philip roared, jumping over an ottoman.
"She pushed me,"
Oliver hollered.
"Because you asked her to, you miserable little wretch."
Philip swung his hand out to grab Oliver's sleeve before he slithered away, but the sneaky little bugger was slippery as an eel.
"Push me,"
Amanda squealed.
"Push me."
"Do not push her,"
Philip yelled. Visions of his drawing room floated ominously in his brain, the image strewn with broken furniture and overturned lamps. Good God, and with the Bridgertons due at any moment. He reached Oliver just as Oliver reached Amanda, and the three of them went tumbling down, taking two cushions off the sofa with them. Philip thanked the Lord for small favours. At least the cushions were not breakable.
Crash! What the devil?
"I think it was the clock,"
Oliver gulped. How on earth they'd managed to topple the clock off the mantel, Philip would never know.
"The two of you are hereby banished to your rooms until you're 68,
he hissed.
"Oliver did it,"
Amanda said quickly.
"I don't give a care who did it,"
Philip bit off.
"You know that Miss Bridgerton is expected at any..."
Philip turned slowly to the doorway, horrified, but not surprised, to see Anthony Bridgerton standing there, Benedict, Sophie and Eloise right behind him.
"My lord,"
Philip said, his voice too curt. Really, he should have been more gracious. It wasn't the Viscount's fault that his children were just one transgression short of being complete monsters, but Philip just couldn't manage good cheer at the moment.
"Perhaps we're interrupting,"
Anthony said mildly.
"Not at all," Philip replied. "As you can see, we're merely rearranging the furniture."
"And doing an excellent job of it,"
Sophie said brightly. Philip shot her a grateful smile. She seemed like the type of woman who always went out of her way to make others feel more comfortable, and at the moment he could have kissed her for it. He rose, stopping to right the overturned ottoman as he did so, then grabbed both of his children by the arms and hauled them to their feet. Oliver's little cravat was now completely undone, and Amanda's hair clip hung limply near her ear.
"May I present my children?"
he said, with all the dignity he could muster.
"Oliver and Amanda Crane."
Oliver and Amanda mumbled their greetings, both looking rather uncomfortable at being paraded before so many adults. Either that, or maybe they were actually shamefaced for their abominable behaviour. Unlikely as that seemed.
"Very well,"
Philip said, once the twins had done their duty.
"You can run along now."
They looked at him with woeful expressions.
"What now?"
"Can we stay?"
Amanda asked in a small voice.
"No,"
Philip answered. He'd invited the Bridgertons over for lunch and a tour of his greenhouse, and he needed the children to disappear back to the nursery if either endeavour was to be successful.
"Please,"
Amanda pleaded. Philip studiously avoided looking at his guests, aware that they were all witnessing his supreme lack of command over his children.
"Nurse Edwards is waiting for you in the hall," he said.
"We don't like Nurse Edwards,"
Oliver said. Amanda nodded beside him.
"Of course you like Nurse Edwards," Philip said impatiently. "She's been your nurse for months."
"But we don't like her."
Philip looked over at the Bridgertons.
"Excuse me," he said in a clipped voice. "I apologise for the interruption."
"It's no bother,"
Sophie said quickly, her face taking on a maternal air as she assessed the situation.
Philip guided the twins to the far corner of the room, then crossed his arms and stared down at them.
"Children," he said sternly, "I have asked Miss Bridgerton to be my wife."
Their eyes lit up.
"Good," he grunted. "I see that you agree with me that this is a superior idea."
"Will she?"
"Don't interrupt me,"
Philip interrupted, too impatient by now to deal with any of their questions.
"I want you to listen to me. I still need to gain approval from her family, and for that I need to entertain them and offer them lunch, and all this without children underfoot."
It was almost the truth, at least. The twins didn't need to know that Antony had practically ordered the wedding and that approval was no longer an issue. But Amanda's lower lip started wobbling, and even Oliver looked upset.
"What now?" Philip asked wearily.
"Are you ashamed of us?"
Amanda asked. Philip sighed, feeling utterly sick of himself.
"Dear God, how had it come to this? I'm not..."
"May I be of assistance?"
He looked over at Eloise as if she were his saviour. He watched in silence as she knelt down near his children, telling them something in a voice so soft that he couldn't understand the words, only the gentle quality of the tone. The twins said something, which was obviously in protest, but Eloise cut them off, gesticulating with her hands as she spoke. Then, to his complete and utter amazement, the twins said their farewells and walked out into the hall. They didn't look especially happy to go, but they did it all the same.
"Thank God I'm marrying you," Philip said under his breath.
"Indeed,"
she murmured, brushing past him with a secretive smile as she walked back to her family. Philip followed her and immediately apologised to Antony, Benedict and Sophie for his children's behaviour.
"They have been difficult to manage since their mother passed,"
he explained, trying to put it in the most excusable terms possible.
"There is nothing more difficult than the death of a parent,"
Antony said quietly.
"Please, do not feel any need to apologise on their behalf."
Philip nodded his thanks, grateful for the older man's understanding.
"Come," he said to the group, "let's go on to lunch."
But as he led them to the dining room, Oliver's and Amanda's faces loomed large in his mind. Their eyes had been sad as they'd walked away. He'd seen his children, obstinate, insufferable, even in full-fledged tantrums, but he'd not seen them sad since their mother had died. It was very troubling. After lunch and a tour through the greenhouse, the quintet broke into two groups. Benedict had brought along an artist's pad, so he and Sophie remained near the house, chattering contentedly as he sketched the exterior. Antony, Eloise and Philip decided to take a walk around the grounds, but Antony very discreetly allowed Eloise and Philip to tarry a good many yards behind, affording the affianced couple the opportunity to speak with some privacy.
"What did you say to the children?" Philip immediately asked.
"I don't know," Eloise said quite honestly. "I just tried to act like my mother."
She shrugged.
"It seemed to work."
He thought about that.
"It must be nice to have parents one can emulate."
She looked at him curiously.
"Didn't you?"
He shook his head.
"No."
She hoped he would say more. Gave him time, even. But he did not speak. Finally, she decided to press the matter and asked,
"Was it your mother or your father?"
"What do you mean?"
"Which of your parents was so difficult?"
He looked at her for a long moment, his dark eyes inscrutable, as his brows ever so slightly came together. Then he said,
"My mother died at my birth."
She nodded.
"I see."
"I doubt you do,"
he said in a tight, hollow voice,
"but I appreciate your trying."
They walked along, keeping their pace slow, not wanting to come within earshot of Antony, even though neither broke the silence for several minutes. Finally, as they turned along the path toward the back side of the house, Eloise uttered the question she'd been dying to ask all day.
Why did you take me into Sophie's study yesterday?
He spluttered and stumbled. I should think that would be obvious, he mumbled, his cheeks turning pink.
Well, yes, Eloise said, blushing as she realized exactly what it was she had asked. But surely you didn't think that was going to happen?
A man can always hope, he muttered.
You don't mean that.
Of course I do. But, he added, looking rather like he couldn't believe he was having this conversation, as it happens, no. It never crossed my mind that matters would get quite so out of hand. He gave her a sly, sideways sort of look. I'm not sorry, however, that they did. She felt her cheeks turn hot.
You still haven't answered my question.
I haven't.
No.
She knew she was being persistent to the point of unseemliness, but as matters went, this seemed an important one to press.
Why did you take me in there?
He stared at her for a full 10 seconds, presumably to ascertain if she was daft, then shot a quick look at Antony to make sure he was out of earshot before answering, Well, if you must know, yes, I did intend to kiss you. You were yapping on about the marriage and asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. He planted his hands on his hips and shrugged. It seemed a good way to prove once and for all that we are well suited. She decided to let his description of her as a yapping female pass.
But passion is surely not enough to sustain a marriage, she persisted.
It's certainly a good start, he muttered. May we talk of something else?
No. What I'm trying to say...
He snorted and rolled his eyes. You are always trying to say something.
It's what makes me charming, she said peevishly.
He looked at her with exaggerated patience. Eloise, we are well suited and will enjoy a perfectly pleasant and amiable marriage. I don't know what else to say or do to prove it.
But you don't love me, she said, her voice soft.
That seemed to knock the wind out of him, and he just stopped and stared at her for the longest moment. Why do you say things like that? He asked. She shrugged helplessly.
Because it's important.
For a moment he did nothing but stare. Hasn't it ever occurred to you that every thought and feeling doesn't need to be given voice?
Yes, she said,
a lifetime of regrets wrapped into that single syllable.
All the time.
She looked away, discomforted by the odd, hollow sensation rumbling in her throat.
I can't seem to help myself, though.
He shook his head, obviously perplexed, which didn't surprise her. Half the time she perplexed herself. Why had she forced the issue? Why couldn't she ever be subtle, coy? Her mother had once told her that she could catch more flies with honey than a sledgehammer, but Eloise never could learn to keep her thoughts to herself. She had practically asked Sir Philip if he loved her, and his silence was as much of an answer as no would have been. Her heart twisted. She hadn't really thought he would contradict her, but her disappointment was proof that some tiny part of her had been hoping that he'd drop to his knees and cry out that he did love her, that he cherished her, and was in fact quite certain that he would die without her, which was all nothing but rot, and she didn't know why she'd even wished for it, when she didn't love him either. But she could. She had this feeling that if she gave it enough time, she could love this man, and maybe she'd just wanted him to say the same.
"Did you love Marina?"
she asked, the words crossing her lips before she'd even had a chance to ponder the wisdom of asking. She winced. There she went again, asking questions that were far too personal. It was a wonder he hadn't thrown up his arms and run screaming in the opposite direction already. He didn't answer for the longest moment. They just stood there, watching one another, trying to ignore Antony, who was studiously examining a tree some 30 yards away. Finally,
in a low voice, Philip said, "No." Eloise didn't feel elated. She didn't feel sorrow. She didn't feel anything at all at his pronouncement, which surprised her. But she did let out a long breath, one she hadn't realized she'd been holding. And she did feel rather glad that she now knew. She hated the not knowing about anything. And so she really shouldn't have been surprised when she whispered, "Why did you marry her?" A rather blank expression washed over his eyes, and finally he just shrugged and said, "I don't know. It seemed like the right thing to do." She nodded. It all made so much sense. It was exactly the sort of thing he would do. Philip was always doing the right thing, the honourable thing, apologising for his transgressions, shouldering everyone's burdens, honouring his brother's promises. And then she had one more question. "Did you?" she whispered, almost losing her nerve. "Did you feel passion for her?" She knew she shouldn't ask, but after that afternoon she had to know. The answer didn't matter, or at least she told herself it didn't. But she had to know. "No." He turned away, began to walk, his long stride forcing her to jump to attention and follow. But then, just when she'd gathered enough speed to catch up, he stopped, causing her to stumble and put her hands out against his arm just to keep her balance. "I have a question for you," he said, his voice abrupt. "Of course," she murmured, surprised by his sudden change of demeanour. Still, it was only fair. She'd practically interrogated the poor man. "Why did you leave London?" he asked. She blinked in surprise. She hadn't been expecting something with such an easy answer.
"To meet you, of course."
"Balderdash." Her mouth fell open at his palpable disdain. "That's why you came," he said. "Not why you left."
It hadn't occurred to her until that very minute that there was a difference. But he was right. He'd had nothing to do with why she'd left London. He'd just provided an easy means of escape, a way to leave without feeling she was running away. He'd given her something to run to, which was so much easier to justify than running from.
"Did you have a lover?"
he asked, his voice low.
"No,"
she answered, loud enough so that Anthony actually turned around, forcing her to smile and wave at him, assuring him that all was well.
"Just a bee,"
she called out. Anthony's eyes widened, and he started to stride in their direction.
"It's gone now,"
Eloise called quickly, shooing him away.
"Nothing about it."
She turned to Philip and explained, "He's rather morbidly afraid of bees." She grimaced. "I forgot. I should have said it was a mouse." Philip looked over at Anthony, curiosity on his face. Eloise wasn't surprised. It was difficult to imagine that a man such as her brother was afraid of bees. But it did make sense, seeing as how their father had died after being stung by one.
"You didn't answer my question."
Damn, she thought she'd got him off the subject.
"How could you even ask it?"
she asked. Philip shrugged.
"How could I not? You ran away from home, not bothering to tell your family where you were going."
"I left a note,"
she interrupted.
"Yes, of course, the note."
Her mouth fell open.
"Don't you believe me?"
He nodded.
"I do, actually. You're much too organized and officious to leave without making sure all of your loose ends were tied up."
"It's not my fault it got shuffled into Mother's invitations,"
she muttered.
"The note is not the issue," he stated, crossing his arms.
Crossing his arms? She clenched her teeth together. It made her feel a child, and there was nothing she could do or say about it, because she had a feeling that whatever he was about to say concerning her recent behaviour, he was right, much as it pained her to admit it.
"The fact of the matter," he continued, "is that you fled London like a criminal in the middle of the night. It simply occurred to me that something might have happened to, stain your reputation."
At her peevish expression, he added, "It's not an unreasonable conclusion to reach." He was right, of course. Not about her reputation. That was still as pure and clean as snow. But it did look odd. And, frankly, it was a wonder he hadn't inquired after it already. "If you had a lover," he said quietly, "it won't change my intentions."
"It's not that at all,"
she said quickly, mostly just to make him stop talking about it.
"It was..."
Her voice trailed off, and she sighed.
"It was..."
And then she told him everything. All about the marriage proposals she'd received, and the ones Penelope hadn't, and the plans they'd jokingly made to grow old and spinsterish together. And she told him how guilty she'd felt when Penelope and Colin had married, and she couldn't stop thinking about herself and how alone she was. She told him all that and more. She told him what was in her mind and what was in her heart, and she told him things she'd never told another soul. And it occurred to her that for a woman who opened her mouth every other second, there was an awful lot inside of her that she'd never shared. And then, when she was done, and in truth she didn't even realize she'd finished, she just kind of ran out of energy and dwindled off into silence, he reached out and took her hand. "It's all right," he said. And it was, she realized. It actually was.
Chapter 14. I grant that Mr. Wilson's face does have a certain amphibious quality, but I do wish you would learn to be a bit more circumspect in your speech. While I would never consider him an acceptable candidate for marriage, he is certainly not a toad, and it ill behooved me to have my younger sister call him thus, and in his presence.
From Eloise Bridgerton to her sister Hyacinth, upon refusing her fourth offer of marriage. 4 days later, they were married. Philip had no idea how Anthony Bridgerton had managed it, but he'd procured a special license, allowing them to be wed without banns and on a Monday, which, Eloise assured him, was no worse than Tuesday or Wednesday, just that it wasn't Saturday as was proper. Eloise's entire family, minus her widowed sister in Scotland, who hadn't had time to make the journey, had trooped out to the country for the wedding. Normally, the ceremony would have taken place in Kent, at the Bridgerton family seat, or at the very least in London, where the family attended church regularly at St. George's in Hanover Square. But such arrangements were not possible on such a hastened schedule, and this wasn't an ordinary sort of wedding in any case. Benedict and Sophie had offered their home for the reception, but Eloise had felt that the twins would be more comfortable at Romney Hall, so they'd held the ceremony at the parish church down the lane, followed by a small, intimate reception on the lawn outside Philip's greenhouse. Later in the day, just as the sun was beginning to dip in the sky, Eloise found herself in her new bedchamber with her mother, who was busying herself by pretending to tuck away items in Eloise's hastily gathered trousseau. It all, of course, had been taken care of by Eloise's lady's maid, brought up from London with the family earlier that morning. But Eloise didn't comment upon her mother's idle busy work. It seemed like Violet Bridgerton simply needed something to do while she talked. Eloise, of all people, understood that need perfectly.
"I should complain that I'm being denied my proper moment of glory as the mother of the bride," Violet said to her daughter, as she folded her lacy veil and placed it gently on top of a bureau. "But in truth, I'm just happy to see you a bride."
Eloise smiled gently at her mother.
"You'd quite despaired of it, hadn't you?"
"Quite." But then she cocked her head to the side and added,
"Actually, no. I always thought you might surprise us in the end.
You frequently do." Eloise thought of all those years since her debut, all those rejected marriage proposals, all those weddings they'd attended, with Violet watching another of her friends marrying off another of their daughters to another fabulously eligible gentleman. Another gentleman, of course,
who could now no longer marry Eloise, Lady Bridgerton's famously on-the-shelf spinster daughter.
"I'm sorry if I've disappointed you," Eloise whispered. Violet gazed at her with a wise expression. "My children never disappoint me," she said softly. "They merely astonish me. I believe I like it that way."
Eloise found herself lurching forward to hug her mother. She felt awkward doing so. She didn't know why, since hers was a family that had never discouraged such displays of affection in the privacy of their own home. Maybe it was because she was so perilously close to tears. Maybe it was because she sensed her mother was the same. But she felt an awkward girl again, all gangly arms and legs and bony elbows and a mouth that always opened when it should be closed. And she wanted her mother. "There, there," Violet said, sounding very much as she had years ago when fussing over a skinned knee or bruised feelings. "Now," she said, her face turning pink. "Now then." "Mother," Eloise murmured. She looked very strange indeed, as if she'd eaten bad fish. "I dread this," Violet muttered.
"Mother?"
Surely she couldn't have heard correctly. Violet took a deep, fortifying breath.
"We have to have a little talk."
She leaned back, looked her daughter in the eye, then added,
"Do we have to have a little talk?"
Eloise wasn't certain whether her mother was asking her if she knew of the details of intimacy, or if she actually knew them, intimately.
I haven't, if you mean, that is to say, I'm still..."
"Excellent," Violet said with a heartfelt sigh.
"But do you, that is to say, are you aware?"
"Yes," Eloise said quickly, eager to spare both of them undue embarrassment.
"I don't believe I need anything explained."
"Excellent," Violet said again, her sigh even more heartfelt.
"I must say, I do detest this part of motherhood. I can't even recall what I said to Daphne, just that I spent the entire time blushing and stammering, and honestly, I have no idea if she left the encounter any better informed than when she arrived."
The corners of her mouth turned down. "Probably not, I'm afraid."
"She seems to have adapted to married life quite well,"
Eloise murmured.
"Yes, she has, hasn't she?"
Violet said brightly. "Four little children, and a husband who dotes upon her. One certainly can't hope for more."
"What did you say to Francesca?"
Eloise asked.
"I beg your pardon?" "Francesca,"
Eloise repeated, referring to her younger sister who had married 6 years earlier and was tragically widowed 2 years after that.
"What did you say to her when she married? You mentioned Daphne, but not Francesca."
Violet's blue eyes clouded, as they always did when she thought of her third daughter, widowed so young.
"You know Francesca. I expect she could have told me a thing or two."
Eloise gasped.
"I don't mean it that way, of course," Violet hastened to add. "Francesca was as innocent as... well, as innocent as you are, I imagine."
Eloise felt her cheeks grow hot and thanked her maker for the cloudy day, which left the room somewhat darkened. That, and the fact that her mother was busy inspecting a torn hem on her dress. She was technically untouched, of course, and she'd certainly pass inspection if examined by a physician, but she didn't feel quite so innocent any longer.
"But you know Francesca,"
Violet continued, shrugging and looking back up when she realized that there was nothing she could do about the hem. "She's so sly and knowing. I expect she bribed some poor housemaid into explaining it all to her years earlier." Eloise nodded. She didn't want to tell her mother that she and Francesca had in fact pooled their pin money to bribe the housemaid. It had been worth every penny, however. Annie Mavel's explanation had been detailed,
and, Francesca had later informed her, absolutely correct. Violet smiled wistfully, then reached up and touched her daughter's cheekbone, right near the corner of her eye. The skin was still slightly discoloured, but the purple had faded through blue and green to a rather sickly, but certainly less unsightly, shade of yellow.
"Are you certain you'll be happy?" she asked.
Eloise smiled ruefully.
"It's a little late to wonder, don't you think? It might be too late to do anything about it, but it's never too late to wonder." "I think I'll be happy," Eloise said.
"I hope so," she added, but just in her mind.
"He seems a nice man."
"He's a very nice man."
"Honourable."
"He is that."
Violet nodded.
"I think you'll be happy. It might take time until you realise it, and you might doubt yourself at first. But you'll be happy. Just remember."
She stopped, chewing on her lip.
"What, mother?"
"Just remember," she said slowly, as if she were choosing each word with great care, "that it takes time. That's all."
"What takes time?"
Eloise wanted to scream, but her mother had already stood up and was briskly smoothing her skirts.
"I expect I shall have to usher the family out, or they will never leave."
She fiddled with a bow on her dress as she turned slightly away. One of her hands reached up to her face, and Eloise tried not to notice that she was brushing aside a tear.
"You're very impatient," Violet said, facing the door. "You always have been."
"I know," Eloise said, wondering if this was a scolding. And if so, why was her mother choosing to do it now?
"I always loved that about you," Violet said. "I always loved everything about you, of course. But for some reason, I always found your impatience especially charming. It was never because you wanted more. It was because you wanted everything."
Eloise wasn't so sure that sounded like such a good trait.
"You wanted everything for everyone, and you wanted to know it all and learn it all, and..."
For a moment, Eloise thought her mother might be done. But then Violet turned around and added,
"You've never been satisfied with second best. And that's good, Eloise. I'm glad you never married any of those men who proposed in London. None of them would have made you happy. Content, maybe, but not happy."
Eloise felt her eyes widen with surprise.
"But don't let your impatience become all that you are," Violet said softly. "Because it isn't, you know. There's a great deal more to you, but I think sometimes you forget that."
She smiled, the gentle, wise smile of a mother saying goodbye to her daughter.
"Give it time, Eloise. Be gentle. Don't push too hard."
Eloise opened her mouth, but found herself entirely incapable of speech.
"Be patient," Violet said. "Don't push."
Eloise had meant to say, "I won't," but her words fell away, and all she could do was stare at her mother's face, only now realizing what it truly meant that she was married. She'd been thinking so much about Philip that she hadn't thought of her family. She was leaving them. She would always have them in all the ways that mattered, but still, she was leaving. And she hadn't realized, until that very moment, how often she sat down with her mother and just talked, or how very precious those moments were. Violet always seemed to know just what her children needed, which was remarkable, really, since there were eight of them. Eight very different souls, each with unique hopes and dreams. Even Violet's letter, the one she'd written and asked Anthony to give to her at Romney Hall, it was exactly right, precisely what Eloise had needed to hear. Violet could have scolded. She could have hurled accusations. She would have been perfectly within her rights to do either, or more. But all she'd written was, "I hope you are well. Please remember that you are my daughter, and you will always be my daughter. I love you. Eloise had bawled. Thank goodness she'd forgotten to read it until late in the night, when she was able to do so in the privacy of her room at Benedict's house. Violet